Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 817, October 10th, 2025. We're covering the Indonesian Grand Prix. I'm hosting Jim McDowell. And with me, as always, riding alongside Richard Jout from the UK. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Jim. We've got lots to talk about. That was an entertaining weekend in various different ways and shapes.
Many things to talk about. There's so much in this show that I think everybody better buckle up and hang on, or at least get a camel back, because you're gonna need some refreshment during this one. Because,
I've got a beer on the go already. I'm ready to go.
I got a lemonade here, so you know we're all good with that or whatever. So I want to thank everyone who listens to the show, everybody who subscribes to the show, everybody who donates to the show. I want to thank you so much for all that. Just remember, guys, we need you to help us get through and cycle up to the top of the algorithms. So if you can, it may not be the easiest thing to do, is what Jake Rallera said, to actually find a way to comment or put a note on a podcast. But if you can, please do. If you can't, that's fine. Just share on social media. When we post up a pod, said, you know, tell your friends, everybody that's out there, and let them go look for it. So appreciate that. I have one shout out. Made some friends over the weekend, Rich, from Pennsylvania. They were into the road racing scene, motorcycle scene, and talked about the podcast, and they found out that they were fans of Mark Marquez. So I hope you guys listened to the podcast. You said you were going to, so shout out to you guys. Enjoyed the weekend with you, and hope you enjoy the show. Take care of that.
Nice.
So as you say, Rich, you wear your gear, and people make all kinds of interesting comments about
you
things.
You never know who you're going to bump into.
Always keep the business card and the sticker handy.
Absolutely.
Those are all there. So... with that, one other piece of like listener feedback, this was from Michael Leety. I hope I got that right, Michael. It's just that this past October 2nd, I believe, right, Rich?
October 6th.
Oh, sorry, the 6th. Sorry, I'm sorry. This October 6th, Jim Race would be 63, I believe. Or 60, okay. Turning 60th. You know, not sure kind of what really happened to him. But I just want to say that, Jim, wherever you are, I hope that you're listening, and I hope that Rich and I are doing a good enough job for you. Because, you know, Jim was sort of the standard. You know, he brought a lot to the show, and, you know, there's been many people before us. Rich, there'll be people after us.
Yeah.
It's just this is just our turn behind the bars, and just as long as we're doing Jim proud, I'll be okay with it.
When I started listening to the show, it was when Jim and Jules were kind of like front and center. Martin was, I guess, in and around it then, and then Dave came shortly afterwards. So, I started Motopod with
Harry.
Yeah, that was a little bit later on again, I guess, wasn't it? But certainly Jim Race was the main guy, the sort of the ebullient one. Jules was that very much more kind of, yeah, down to earth kind of a guy I always used to feel, and Jim was kind of a bit out there, and I, you know, I loved that. And as Michael Leet said, you know, those famous kind of interviews with Miller.
Mark Miller.
And yeah, just, yeah, made me sort of reminisce a little bit, because we're kind of, you do forget, don't you? Because years have gone by and we don't know what happened to other Jim, and I guess we'll never know, but it's nice to remember people. So it was great, you know, that Michael took the trouble, and also Michael saying that he's been there since day one.
It's,
you know,
crazy
when Bob started the thing
long.
Off. So I mean, you know, really brilliant. I mean, I certainly haven't been around that long, because as I say, I started listening, I guess, around about 2012, 2013, I think it would have been, somewhere around about. I have to remember back, it's quite a long time ago now. But yeah, just nice to remember people, you know, fallen comrades and stuff. And yeah, wherever he is, we hope he's sort of doing okay, either in this world or the next. So yeah, happy birthday, Jim.
Yep. All right. With that, Rich, let's just delve into the news and talk about what we know. So let's start with preseason testing dates have dropped. So mark your calendars, people. The shakedown test happens the 29th and 31st of 29th through the 31st of January. Then there is the CPAHN test, 3rd through the 5th of February. Then the season launch happens on the 6th through the 7th of February, and the Buriram test happens on the 21st through the 22nd of February, assuming that we're talking either that first weekend of March or possibly to be the first race of the year there in Thailand. So that is where things are with that. So, there is no off season now, Rich.
Well, exactly. I was just about to say that. I mean, it's 3 months, isn't it? Effectively, when is the last MotoGP race? I'm trying to think.
It's right around
It's
US Thanksgiving.
Valencia, isn't it? Sort of mid-November, is that early mid-November? So, yeah. I mean, long gone are the days of like, half a year of racing and half a year of not. We won't get into it now. It's possibly one for the off season, but is the season too long? Is there not enough time? I mean, it's good for people that like to watch the racing. I mean, we're like pigs in the proverbial SH, you know what? But for the everybody that's involved in actually putting the show on the road, it's a grueling calendar, isn't it?
Yeah, when we were doing the triple headers, that was grueling. That was enough to break me.
And set to get bigger, according to what we were talking about last week. I mean, what are we at? 21, 22 rounds? They're talking about 25. I mean, it's almost to the
That's
stage
too
where
much.
how the hell do you get an off season into that, really, of any sort of meaningful use?
Ridiculous. I'm of the look that, like, hey, racing's great. And I'm all for it, but there needs to be some time for the crews and everybody else to be at home, honestly. And I always thought the right number, and maybe this is just because when I came into the sport, was they had between 15 and 18 rounds in a season, and I thought that was about right. Okay, we stretched it to 20. I'm good. Okay, that's fine because you can do some double headers, have a weekend off, double header, have a weekend off. You're staying relevant to this to it. But I don't want it to be like Moto America in the US, where they have maybe 10 weekends and it's a month off in between. It doesn't stay current. In today's society, I'm sorry, it just doesn't stay current. You need to be current. You not every weekend, but every other weekend, and then, hey, well, let's have a summer break, right? Which is fine. But yeah, it's start 25 is because that's if there's 25, that's 50 races for MotoGP.
Yeah, and obviously it brings into question, particularly with MotoGP, with, as you say, the sprint as well as the main race. If you get injured, there's just no time to recover, really. And I mean, we've already seen it. I mean, Indonesia this weekend just gone is a good example. There were several riders missing. There just isn't time to rest and recuperate now. And in my ideal world, with Liberty in charge of World Superbike and MotoGP, I can't see why they can't kind of keep MotoGP where it is, or even shrink it slightly. I know that's almost like a heresy to say that, but say 20 rounds and take World Superbike, which is, again, has these crazy long gaps and is basically only running bar one or two races in Europe. Sort of increase that a little bit, have them visiting different venues, not kind of having weekends where they clash, which does happen quite regularly during the season, albeit there aren't that many World Superbike races. Yeah, to me, they ought to be promoting both series properly and avoiding clashes and making the most of everything that they've got. I know MotoGP is the premier class and it will always be that. Everybody knows that and everybody accepts that. It's always been the case. But I do think they're kind of, squeezing a quart from a pint pot on that one. And as you say, go back years gone by, you maybe not in bike racing, but again, with the old Formula One cap temporarily on, you literally had separate teams that were involved in testing, and then you had the race crews and stuff. And so they were able to, because money was not restricted in those days, they could run these big separate teams. And it's almost, we've touched on this before, almost feels like you need separate teams now for MotoGP so that some people do get some downtime. Because, I mean, flipping out, people have families, for goodness sake. I mean, these guys and girls are away 3/4 of the year, pretty much. It's not
Yeah,
great.
I have this wild idea. It just kind of came to me right now. Was we were talking about how maybe the Moto 2 and Moto 3 guys weren't going to be traveling the world from a financial standpoint. How about this craziness? I'm throwing this out here. Let's make an assumption. This is based on one assumption. The assumption is that Liberty will change World Superbike from a 1,000 cc flat to, let's call it, a 600 or 700 cc max capacity kind of, and make it a very super sporty thing, right? Base it more in a super sport rules or a super stock kind of rules.
I think that's where it's
This is
going.
my, yeah. So if they do that in 27, how about you have a world championship where you got flyaways where the World Superbike and MotoGP races on the same weekend? So you come to COTA, I see World Superbike and I see World and I see MotoGP. I can easily tell you the difference between the two bikes, right? I think you'd be fantastic because it makes the World Superbike a world championship because we've looked at the calendar and commented how it's in Europe. So it's more of a European championship. So I think it's kind of like, why not? It seems to be like the right idea, but I'm hijacking the news with ideas, which is
No,
the whole point.
I think it's a eminently sensible idea. And I know MotoGP 27 onwards is set to become a little bit less sort of space age in terms of all these gizmos and appendages and stuff, but it's still MotoGP, right? So I mean, it's still going to be not the sort of thing that you race on Sunday and pop down to the dealer and buy on the Monday. So having some crossover into a more production-based category running at the same time, at least at some rounds, to me, makes an awful lot of sense. Yeah, I don't understand why it hasn't happened before, to be honest with you. And I mean, we do get that the Moto2 and Moto3 teams are a bit stretched financially, and a 25 race calendar may just be beyond the means from a sponsorship standpoint, quite apart from the logistics of it. So if you could fill some of those slots, particularly on some of the more, distant destinations that we go to with an expanded production series like World Superbike, particularly if it goes more super sporty. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, Jim. I think that's a great idea.
Well, some of you folks write in motopodcast.com, whether you like my idea or not. Let's continue down the MotoGP theme here with the next bit of news that Marc Marquez, after the weekend, he had the crash. We'll talk about the crash and dissect it later. But he has a fracture at the base of the coracoid process. Now, I had no clue what that was. So you know what I did? I asked my wife. She looked at me, it's his shoulder blade. Okay. So he's sort of cracked his shoulder blade and he has ligament injury also to that same right shoulder. Now, none of that has anything to do with his humerus bone. There's no problem whatsoever with that. He will miss the next two rounds as he as he is recuperating and letting the fracture heal on its own because no surgery was determined to be required, but he's going to miss Australia, which that's going to kill him. Because Mark loves the island. He's not going to really care about Sepang because he's never really done well there. It's not one of his favorite tracks. Like Mandalika is not one of his favorite tracks either,
No.
basically. So, so that's going on with him. But I have to say, I am glad that he has, as he had told Jorge Martin, you need to rest. You got to stay off the bike. You got to recuperate. You need to do this for you, for your body, for your health, for all this. And if he would have gotten some surgery and been back on the bike at the island, I would have been severely angry with him. Other than if he was in a title race, I would have granted a pass, a hall pass for it, but there was no need for him to be back. So stay home, recuperate, rest, get it to where the doctors say, yep, we're okay, then come back. And if that isn't until testing after Valencia, so be it.
Yeah, I think he's opened and closed a few too many windows to make that mistake again, Jim, to be honest. And he doesn't need to race, does he? So why put yourself through it, particularly on the flyaways, because you're putting your body through strain anyway, just with the travel, never mind the healing process. I mean, the slightly more concerning part of the injury is actually, I would imagine, and again, your wife would be in a better position to comment on this than I am, but is the ligament damage bit, because ligaments around shoulders can be very, very tricky, and you certainly don't want to push those harder than necessary too early on, because that's ended more than a few racers' careers. Take Maverick Vinales as a good recent example. I mean, he's really struggling to come back, having messed his shoulder up in that crash at the Sachsenring. What was that? All the way back in July? So July, August time. I mean, it's
July.
quite a while ago now, considering how often these guys come back really, really quickly, because they are obviously super fit athletes and they do recover very quickly. But yeah, so it makes sense for Mark to sit a couple of races out, because it's funny, isn't it? Goes all season without too many crashes and keeping out of trouble, and then as soon as he's won the championship, this happens. But at least he's won the championship. Coming back maybe for the Valencia round, the final round, it's just a little drive down the road for him, isn't it? It just makes sense to go the sensible route now. And it's good to, as you, I think insinuated Jim is he's got a bit older and a bit wiser, having made a few too many mistakes like this in the past. And well done for keeping it together when I made my Windows joke. I ploughed on through despite you laughing on
It was so
camera.
funny. Oh, it was so funny. Oh, okay. Speaking of other injured riders, Jorge Martin will spend the next few days at the Red Bull Athlete Performance Center in Austria to focus on his recovery. And so, I mean, Red Bull has got this amazing facility there with the top flight doctors and physical therapists and everything that you need to recover. They're used to dealing with high performance athletes. So it's a really good place for him to go to get himself back, to get over all of his injuries. So I applaud the move, for him to be there for a few days, week, whatever it's going to be. The market is starting to thin down now. So in that news for Moto2, Dennis Onchu has been confirmed at Mark VDS. So that is where he is going. Okay, great. Also in the now moving to Moto3, Casey O'Gorman, who came in and subbed, was that the Hungaroring? Not the Hungaroring, but the Hungry Round or whatever. Gorman came in and ran two
Yeah, he
races.
ran a couple of races, didn't he? When Lunetta was out with his broken leg post Assen, I think it was when he picked up that injury.
Somewhere around there. And he was very good. So he has been signed to the 658 Corsa squad. So good to see an Irishman back in the racing, right?
Well, I mean, we've passed comment just recently about how tough of an environment that team is. So, I mean, obviously, given the opportunity as a full-time ride, and it is as much as you can take this ever as being true, but it is a 2-year deal as things stand. So, he's got time to establish himself, but he obviously showed really, really well, didn't he, Jim,
Yeah, he
on
did.
those
He
couple of
was
sub
really good.
rides? I mean, he's done very, very well in Britain over the years. So yeah, I mean, it's good to see another fast Brit making it into Moto3, because it's a tough old, as is the case for the Americans as well. It's tough to get into this championship. There's not a lot of money behind people to support these moves, so I'm hopeful. But he is in a tough team there. If he doesn't perform, Signor Simoncelli will make his feelings known, no doubt.
Through a blog.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Last thing is an injury related Moto3 rider, and that is that David Munoz will have a fra has a fracture in his left femur. The assumption here is that he is done for the year, considering the largest bone in the body, which is sad because of the that came from the crash that happened obviously this week past weekend. So yeah, there was quite the craziness going on in Mandalika for sure.
We will come to the reason for that injury, I guess, when we talk about the race, because it was a pretty poor move. Although ironic that it should have been on David Munoz, of all people, that comes off second best. But I'm not suggesting that there's any sort of right or wrong about that. But it's just funny the way the cookie crumbles sometimes.
And quickly with World Superbike, it is the Estoril round, which is in Portugal. And it is possible for Toprak to take the title this weekend. So keep your eye on that one, folks.
Yeah, so it's Estoril this weekend, and then they finish off a week or two after that in Jerez. So Toprak has a, well, not a comfortable points lead. I mean, Buhlig can still win the championship, but Toprak's got some comfort level there. Now, for me, I kind of would like him to win the title. Nothing against Buhlig. I mean, Buhlig's had a really great season too. But I think if Toprak comes to MotoGP as the reigning triple World Superbike champion, that would be pretty cool, I think. So for people to come from World Superbike to MotoGP, I think it's helpful if they come as a champion or the current champion. So I've kind of got my fingers crossed for him a bit on that one.
So one question here. Toprak first won his title on what brand of motorcycle?
Yamaha.
A Yamaha. Okay. And now he's back at Yamaha. Okay.
No. So he won it on the
Well,
Yamaha, and then
yeah,
he
then
switched to
BMW.
BMW. So he won the championship on the BMW last year,
Right.
and he's defending on the BMW this
He's
year
defending on the
before
BMW.
he goes back to Yamaha and
Okay.
MotoGP. Yeah.
I thought he had gone back to Yamaha for this season of World
No.
Superbike. That's okay. My bad, because I was gonna say, wow, if you win three titles on three different bikes, that would make you in some elite, very elite in any world championship, because nobody's ever really done it.
In World Superbike, I don't think anybody's won on three different brands. No.
Nobody's done it in MotoGP, which is why I want Marquez to move to
Yeah.
KTM or something at some point, just to prove it can be done. Well, anyway, That's it. That's the news, right? We're all good. Everybody's caught up. Let's move into qualifying from the weekend. We'll start with, of course, the little bikes, the Moto 3 class. Now, the qualifying here, qualifying one, seemed to be like it was weirdly basically boring in Moto 3, which is weird, which doesn't make really any sense. But it was Rossi, Pininfarina, Rolston, Lunetta, Pironi, and Moodley are the kind of the names that are in there that you're thinking, wow, those guys usually are one or more of those guys are generally in the second session already. They were not there. Now, Pironi was not going to take part in the qualifying session and would not take part in the race. He was declared unfit due to a crash that he had. So he was unable to do what he needed to do to pass fit to be able to ride. But at the end of the 15 minutes, Moodley, Lunetta, Rollstone, and Pini all got a ticket to go to Q2. Now in Q2, they waited around for a little bit before anybody wanted to go out, which is weird and whatnot. And that would go to haunt some people because, halfway through, Keelys was on top, followed by Fernandez, Rueda, then Rollstone, Almanza, and Lunetta. Now, when we got past that, we had like everybody was waiting to go back out again. Like everybody was looking to back time it to be like the last person to get to the finish line. And there were some big names that really were trying to get there and they couldn't because they left too late in the pit lane, which I cannot understand how we cannot figure out how to back time when you have to go down the pit lane. I just do not get it, Rich. You send your guy out on a bike, you take a stopwatch, you click it, you see how long it takes him to get to the end of the pit lane, click, and then you figure, okay, if let's say the lap for average lap time is 1:40 for a Moto 3 bike, well, guess what? It's going to be closer to almost 2 minutes to get around because you've got cold tires.
You would
So
think.
you add the two together, you subtract from the 15 minutes you got, and you go out at that time. I'm sorry.
We've
I'm
spoken about this
sorry. I
until we're
know.
blue in the face. We don't
I'm sorry.
understand something here, and clearly the teams do not understand something either.
I'm not so sure it's the teams that are the problem because in this instance, everybody sort of kind of left within a reasonable amount of time to make that point. There was some lollygagging by the riders. That's the problem in this one. And it's like, come on, guys. You're there to ride the bike. Go ride the bike. I gotta have a tow thing. This, I gotta be following somebody, or I want clear track and I don't want anybody to follow me. Just get over it. Just get over it and get out there and get on with the job that you have to deal with. And that's one of the things I can't wait to, I mean, I can't wait till we get to the 500 or 700 displacement class here where we can get away from this idea of having to have a partner to draft with because I need those couple of tenths. Because the straightaway is really long here, or whatever it is, right?
But that's the bizarre thing at Mandalika, though, isn't it? There isn't really a long straight, so the tow is not really a thing there. And of all the places that you don't want to be sat around in full leathers and a helmet, you would have thought they'd have been desperate to get out. I mean, not that you get much relief from the air in that part of the world anyway, because it's so bloody hot and humid. Yeah, sitting around in the pits, fully leathered up and stuff. That must have been just nightmarishly hot.
That second sector is a fast flowing sector that leads into the third, which is kind of fast and flowing too. So I can understand having like a reference point to kind of go with there because the track is so it's wide, it's a very wide track, but then it has a mile of pavement on each side of it, which how do you really know where your marker is per se, right? I mean,
Yeah.
so I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying I can understand it a little bit out here just because of the circumstances of this place.
But there are some riders that generally just go out and do laps on their own and just run their lines, just get faster each lap. I'm surprised more riders in Moto3 don't do it. Anyway, who knows? I mean, but we talk about this often, don't we? And this nonsense of hanging around and then missing the flag is just, well, it's comical, really.
Yeah. So if one with like essentially like one lap basically to be left to go. Fernandez was on pole with Munoz second, then Kelso, Carpe, Furisato, and Keelys. Now, as it turned out, a lot of guys just did sneak in to get that last lap past the timesheet, but nobody was faster than Fernandez as he would take the pole. Munoz would start in the middle of the front row. Kelso jumped up from where he was. Or sorry, he stayed in third. That was there, and then it's Carpe, Furisato, Keelys, Almanza, Lunetta, then our championship leader Rueda, and then Guido Pini, Piqueras, Foggia making up the first three first four rows of the grid. So I was like, okay, whew, right. Well, now we get to get into the racing. Now, what we need to understand is that Rueda has an opportunity to clinch the world title here in Mandalika. It's really kind of simple math. After this round, there's four races left at 25 points. That's 100 points. So all Rueda's got to do is have 100 points or more lead over Piqueras, and he's got it. The simple math to all this is that if Rueda wins and Piqueras is third, the title is his. Now, there's a whole bunch of other permutations, but that's the simple math. You can figure the rest of it out from there. So we get to the start. And there was some serious jostling back and forth for these guys through the first three, four corners of the lap. It was really wild. I had to wait for things to settle out a little bit before I could figure out and put on paper who was where. It was really some amazing racing there through the first few corners as everybody was all over everybody. It settled into Kelso leading from Munoz, from Fernandez, and then Kelys. Then Carpe and Piqueras. Rueda, a terrible start. He was down in ninth to begin with, but he was farther even back. He was 13th. So I'm on a Rueda watch because we've seen Rueda win from way back. So who knows what's going to happen here in this one. So we'll see what goes on. Munoz and Fernandez had taken control at turn, had taken control of the race and turn 10 as they got together. Now, Munoz is banging on the bar as they come out of that turn where they've come together. And it was like his brake guard on the front had come up. So Munoz is just beating that thing back into position. So good on him for that one. It was a true bar banging race at that point, because we got everybody touching everybody and things are just crazy going on. But Fernandez is out front, followed by Kelys, then Almanza, then Munoz, Piqueras, and Kelso. Now Rueda is 10th, and he's 1.2 seconds off of the lead, which is not far in terms of Moto 3. So this is looking good. Then Munoz is around the outside of Piqueras, cuts off his front end, and Piqueras goes wide. Then Kelso's down at 16. He lost the rear. It looked like to me he just missed the line by a millimeter or two. That rear got out on the dusty, dirty part of the track, and it just spun out from underneath of him. And there's a lot of other instances like that, but I'll say it here. I'm wondering if this track, due to the hard carcass tires that they have to use because of the heat, the humidity, and the lack of use of the circuit, meaning it's dirty, coupled with the salty sea air that somehow wreaks havoc at Misano every now and then, is this track, Rich, the new Qatar, where we used to have all the problems with the dew settling as that night race happened? What do you think?
Yeah, well, certainly it's one of the tracks where they frequently talk about, and you can see if you go off that kind of bit of rubber that gets laid down as the laps go on over the course of the weekend, you are going to lose either a lot of time or you're going to lose the front or the rear of the bike. And as you say, Jim, I mean, you can see the waves crashing quite spectacularly onto the sort of the shoreline not too far away. So that must have some effect. I mean, I did have that thought myself watching it over the course of the weekend. And you do see a very distinct kind of dark line building up over the weekend, and it is treacherous if you stray away from that. So, I mean, it must be a thing, mustn't it? In the same way that, I mean, in Qatar, you get the sand blowing on to those parts of the track where the bikes are not typically running along. So, again, if you sort of stray onto that, you're in bother. And we don't see this at most of the European tracks because they're in the middle of big land masses and outside of incumbent weather, you just don't get these other sort of curveball effects, do you? So, yeah, to me, and I say this as an armchair enthusiast, of course, it introduces a sort of a level of interest. I don't want to use the word jeopardy because that insinuates I'm looking forward to people sort of running into trouble, which I'm not. But it does put an extra demand on the riders for sure to try and keep things sensible, which in Moto 3 you sort of say with a certain degree of laughter on your face, don't you? Because these guys typically don't keep it sensible. And Adrian Fernandez was just on a bit of a mission this weekend, quite what the mission was. I mean, it's up for debate. Because I think it was him that ran into Munoz early on to cause the whole brake lever or brake guard thing to be sort of out of whack, which resulted in Munoz giving it a whack to try and get it back into position. So, bit of a kind of crazy racetrack this, but it always runs up some pretty entertaining races because it was a good weekend across all three classes, I thought.
Yeah, for sure. And back to where we were here in Moto3. We're like about lap seven or so. Keeley's moves to the front. He's leading now. Rueda now starts to slowly work his way and do some magic that he seems to have. He started out in lap eight at seventh. He's gotten from 10th to seventh in a couple laps. He gets to lap nine. He had moved to fifth. Then he was the third with everybody else diving underneath everybody else and pushing everybody offline. Rueda just simply floated on by past everybody, and he just made it look simple. He made it look easy, and it was quite amazing to watch him work. It's like you understand why this kid has the potential of being world champion and why he's so good. It's just there. And I mean, for me, I thought Pedro Acosta was a great Moto3 rider. I mean, he was, right? You had then in Then you had Alonso, right? He won so many races, and Alonso tend to win them sort of in the last couple of laps, right? He was always in the lead train, the lead group, right? And I thought, well, he's patient, and he just knows, and he, boom, turns the wick up, gotcha. Rueda is a different individual. I think he may be the most patient Moto3 rider I've ever seen. He completely is nonflummoxed if something bad happens at the start. I mean, if you watch the start again, you see, he just simply is patient. He's like, okay, a little more brake here. I'm going to turn in. Got this. Oh, you've gone by. No problem. Hey, okay, I'm going to slot in here. I'm going to see what's going on. Let everybody kind of get the crazy out of the way. And then he just methodically just picks up the pace and just rolls through the field. He has this internal clock of somehow knowing when he needs to go and push. And it's amazing to watch him work in that way. It's so different from the way Acosta did it, from the way Alonso did it, right? But it's one of the coolest ways for me. I don't know, maybe it's the X Racer. I wish I could have been that good, but the way Rueda goes about this is fascinating, especially these last races. He has not qualified well, really, for the last four or five. He's had decent-ish starts to be, quote, in the top 10, and then just slowly rides through to the front. You never see it coming because there's no flashes, no fastest laps, there's nothing else. And you're usually enthralled by the battle that's going on out in front anyway. And all of a sudden, boom, here comes Rueda. There's another win. Fascinating.
We've made the comparison with Lorenzo. I don't really remember Lorenzo on 125s as it would have been back then. I mean, I did watch it back in those days, but Rueda is, I mean, they're all incredibly fast. Obviously, they're in Moto3, but what he is just kind of, and it almost sounds like I'm sort of damning with false praise, and I'm not. He's fast and steady, which most of them are not. They're sort of fast and crazy. Whereas, as you say, he doesn't panic and he has a real knack of just kind of staying out of trouble. But when he needs to pull the pin, he kind of can. And he's particularly effective once he gets out front, if he's allowed to run some laps, which is why so many people tried to follow him in practice and qualifying, for example. Again, I will always reserve judgment on Moto3 champions until they've either started to do well or not in Moto2. Because I think it's such a big jump to Moto2. If you can't make it, you're unlikely to succeed in MotoGP. So I think we have to reserve judgment a bit, but as a Moto3 racer this year, he's been devastatingly good. But I mean, we said the same about Alonso, we said the same about Acosta. Yeah, I mean, he is, well, I won't jump it too far ahead, but he's been head and shoulders the best all year long, really, despite some slightly patchier form just of late. But again, he hasn't panicked in the recent races and he's banked a lot of points, even though he hasn't won a lot of races. So you can't really ask for more.
Yep, it's been great. So you're at like lap 10. Piqueras is in 10th place. It is amazing racing at this point. I mean, everybody's going somewhere, passing somebody, and it doesn't matter where it is on the track. Either you don't know where to look. You don't know where to look in the pack. One of the best Moto3 races of the year, I thought this one was myself personally, just because
For
of
sure.
everything that was going on. It's really crazy. By lap 13, Rueda is now in the lead, jockeying. He's by Fernandez. Now, Keelys and Fernandez go wide. at six, and Rueda is like wide at 16, and then Rueda just slices back up the inside, right? So Rueda is way on the outside. Here comes, Fernandez and Quiles. They're on the inside, and then boom, they're wide, and like somehow Rueda knew this was going to happen. He just cut to the inside. I swear, I think he had to have had eyes in the back of his helmet because it just, how did he know? But again, this is what makes this kid on another level of special from all like the other ones, right? Like we always go back and we talk about the Moto3 guys and stuff. And we sort of say, well, Acosta was special, right? Yeah, that was easy to see, right? And well, Alonso's special. Well, that's easy to see. But this is a different subtle kind of special that Rueda really does have. And again, holding back the judgment of what's going to happen to him when he's on a bigger bike. But man, he's got a great foundation to work from. That much I will give you.
He has great racing instincts, that's for sure. So he kind of knew what was going to happen there. So he second guessed it, didn't he? And then took advantage when what he thought was going to happen actually happened straight away. So yeah, no, he's a very effective Sunday racer.
So for Asato, Almanza, and Carpe, there's like a crash there at 16. Now, for Asato, well, it goes under Carpe, and then they go slightly wide, and then Almanza goes up under, and then he contacts with them, and then they all go down sort of in a hump. Now, Carpe smacked his head viciously as he went over, as his bike, the other two kind of slid into his bike, and that forced his bike to kick him up and throw him over the handlebars on a high side. And he came down and just went the whap on the back of that helmet. I'd be surprised that helmet wasn't cracked because that pit was quite vicious there. But with 15 laps in the books, Rueda is leading Munoz, leading Fernandez, Quiles, Piqueras, and Luneta. That would give him the world title because, Piqueras is farther back down than third. But Piqueras, Quiles, and then Piqueras get a long lap penalty because of a shortcut they took at turn nine. Now, on lap 17, Piqueras then takes the penalty. Quiles doesn't take the penalty, which he's supposed to, but he hasn't taken it yet. So Quiles immediately goes to the long lap, but you've got 3 laps to do it in. And so Quiles stays on the track, and we get with 3 to go. Munoz goes to the front. He's now at the front. He's by Rueda, and then Fernandez goes with him. So we move Rueda back toward the third. Fernandez then goes up the inside of Munoz at 12, at turn 12, and then Munoz has a nasty crash as Fernandez basically just, it's a win it or bin it move, smashes into him, and that flips Munoz over the handlebars, causing that fractured femur that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Now, at that time, that happens. They're going on to 2 laps to go. Quiles then goes to the long lap penalty loop to take his penalty, which is at the correct time because it's 3 laps have passed. So he's going to the box. Fernandez and Rueda are going after each other, and Luneta and Pini. So that's there. Then it goes to a red flag because Munoz is injured, right? They need medical attention. Because femurs, if you break a femur, that can be really bad because you can cut one of the major arteries. If you had a compound fracture of the bone, you can cut one of the major arteries in your body and you will bleed to death from the result of a broken bone. So good on Simon Crafar and the team to just go throw the flag. Now, this leads to a bit of controversy as Rueda now wins because he's out front. Quiles believes that he's technically second, and they put his bike in second in Parc Fermé. That's not the case because he still hadn't taken the long lap penalty when the checker flag, or sorry, when the red flag was put out. So they gave him like a 3 second penalty, which dropped him down the list. So it's basically we get the race pat podium is Rueda, world champion, because Piqueras was nowhere close to him. Luneta, who had snuck up along the way and through the attrition of all the crashing that's happening to end the race, is in second. Then Guido Pini is third on the podium. Then it's Quiles, because of the time penalty, he gets dropped back to fourth. Then Rolston, Fernandez, Piqueras, then Yamanaka, Nepa, Kelso, Bertelli, Faggia, Moodley, Morelli, and Eddie O'Shea gets the last point. A crazy ending to a crazy good race. It's a shame Munoz is hurt, and I get that. But still, Rich, I thought great race by Rueda. He is world champion. He captures the world championship with a win, which I think most people would like to do. Not just say I rode around to get the points. I won the championship. So congratulations to Rueda, your 2025 Moto3 world champ.
Well deserved. Been the best rider in Moto3, consistently the best all year long. At the end of the day, it's a over 100 points lead that he's got now, so you can't argue with the points, can you?
No.
What else to say, really? I mean, Fernandez had a bit of a Fernandez day, didn't he, really? And I mean, we haven't really sort of touched too much on that incident with Munoz, but he basically just ran a line where he should have known another bike was going to be there, I think. I mean, obviously, because of the way the sort of the messy end to the race, there was no penalty given for that, but I'm quite confident he will have a penalty to serve in Phillip Island as a result of that. Munoz, as you say, Jim, he's definitely done for this season. I mean, in a way, it doesn't matter too much because the championship is now in Rueda's hands, and again, with Quiles in mind, that was just kind of crappy timing, really, wasn't it? It was a bit unfortunate, but I don't imagine Quiles is going to lose too much sleep over it because these guys just are only interested in winning races and winning championships, aren't they? And he did have the good grace. I don't know if you spotted it, as he sort of trudged slightly crestfallen up the pit lane. He did hand his second place cap over to somebody to take back down to Parc Fermé to give to Lunetta, who inherited that place. Well, not inherited, he obviously won it according to the rules. So the only other thing that I thought was just noteworthy and wouldn't normally get a mention, but Jacob Ralston in fifth place, who is without a ride next year, let's not forget.
That's true.
That was a very, very good position and a good result for him, because I mean, he definitely deserves to stay in Moto3 next year. If he's out of Tech 3, as we know, those places are taken, but I'm hoping that he will get picked up by another team. He definitely deserves a bit more time because he's had quite a bit of bad luck this year as well, with engine failures or technical failures anyway, and some strong performances. So, and that was another one on Sunday. And Kelso obviously crashed, got back on, and finished what in 10th place. So, again, fair play. Furusato crashed and then remounted and immediately crashed again. So there is some debate about whether riders having crashed should be able to get back on the bike. Not a debate for now. Again, that's perhaps one for another day, but sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But fair play to Kelso, because again, in that heat and that humidity, having gone down, it would be easy to sort of go and jump in the ice pool and just cool off a little bit. But no, fair play. He got back on the bike and got a good finish in the end. But yeah, just congratulations to Rueda, who has continue to embarrass me all season long because I completely missed him off my list of people that I thought were going to be in contention for the championship. I'm pretty sure I said I thought Piqueras would win the championship this year. And okay,
Both had
he's in
Piqueras.
a strong second place, it's true, but he has had an overall disappointing season, I would say.
He moves on to Moto2 next year, so I don't think he really cares.
Well, no, I mean, obviously you have to move on at this point and hope to do better. Yeah, I mean, it's been a disappointing season, I think, really, for Piqueras.
So Rueda, he's going to Tech 3 to partner Vire, right? Yeah. So he's going there as the world champion for Moto3.
Sorry, not Tech 3. No, it'll be the IO
Sorry, the actual
team.
IO team.
It's the
My
IO
bad.
team. Yeah.
My bad. Sorry. So Rueda goes to the IO team as Moto3 world champion. He's got a 340 points, which is 109 more than what Piqueras has, and there's only 100 points left. So you can do that math real simply. After him, it's Quiles, who has the best point reward ratio of anybody, considering he couldn't start two races because of his age and set two races due to injury, and he's third. And he's only 14 behind Piqueras. And I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't take Piqueras for second.
I wouldn't be surprised either.
Especially with the last two rounds being in the Iberian Peninsula. Yeah, look for Keeley just to win those out pretty much. Because I don't think Rueda cares anymore now. I mean, he might if he, I don't know what he's going to put into it, but I'd be on vacation mode for sure. Munoz is the question mark here because he's on 197 points. Kelso is 38 points behind, but Munoz is not going to probably ride for the last four races of the year.
No,
And
I think he's done.
if Kelso can be in the top five, he probably has a good chance of being, being fourth in championship.
Yeah, it's possible. Not that he will take much pleasure from doing it with a rider
No.
that's out injured, but yeah, I mean, Minhoff's fourth place is a bit vulnerable, I would say.
Yeah.
The only other thing that we didn't mention earlier on, Jim, I just noticed in my notes is that, and this is kind of like a news item, but Almansa was confirmed to go over to the Intact GP Moto3
About that
squad
one.
alongside Minhoff next year. So basically, Almansa and Pini have swapped teams because Pini goes to Leopard and Almansa replaces him in the Intact
Wow.
team. So
I forgot that one.
yeah, kind of got mentioned on the TNT coverage and I forgot to write it in the notes, to be honest, but I just spotted it on my written notes. So yeah, an entertaining Moto3 race with a slightly messy, disappointing end, all told, really, because it was building up to a bit of a crescendo, that one. And obviously, the red flag had to come out, but it was a shame, really, because that was building up to something special. But anyway, there we go.
I think turn 16 would have been really fantastic,
Yeah, because
but
that just invites trouble,
yes,
that turn.
sure does. All right, let's move on to Moto 2 and look at how these guys qualified. In the first session is Vietti, Guevara, Roberts, Lopez, Canet again, Szalacs, and Agius. Now, there's some guys really shouldn't probably be there, but lo and behold, there they are. Agius was down at turn one, and that was a problem. Szalacs, and almost down. I mean, he was really close, and because he clamped down really hard on the front and then went down halfway through Szalacs, it was good enough to be getting out with Guevara, Juarez, and Vietti. With like about 1:50 left to go, Escrige went to pole, or to the fastest person, I should say, and that was pretty wild. And then if he was followed by Vietti and Canet, who were outside looking in, but at the very end, you had Escrige, Szalacs, Guevara, and Vietti all get to the next session. It was a bit of a botch up there because people, again, didn't quite have it all together and right. And it's like some people were sitting and they were thinking people are going to go faster than you, but they didn't do it because Escrige didn't have another lap left. He rolled out and didn't go for a final lap. And I thought for sure Escrige was not going to get through, but he made the Ford look pretty good for that weekend. Or at least for that moment in time. In the second qualifying session, Gonzalez got a time scrubbed because of yellow flags in the first sector, as he was trying to go super quick, couldn't because of that problem. Halfway through, Alonso is ahead of Holgado, ahead of Ramirez. So you got the, gosh, it's the CFMoto team, which is Aspar, right? So the Aspar boys are 1-2, pretty wild. Then Ramirez, Morera, Guevara, and then Sasaki. Now Gonzalez goes to second. It's like, okay, cool. It's game on here with Morera, right? But Guevara is then second because he bumps Gonzalez. Then, as we're watching that, we get a red helmet coming from Morera, who then shoots up to pole because, he's like the fourth fastest guy. Now he just jumps everybody to get to there. So then it's Alonso. So then it's Morera on pole, followed by Alonso, then Guevara, then Gonzalez. Holgado gets himself bumped back to fifth place in that second row. Then Ramirez, Vire, Dixon, and Baltus. So that's how that goes down for the qualifying session. Anyhow, we get into the Moto2 race. And the interesting, we got 22 laps here. When it starts off, it's Guevara who hops out front, followed by Marrero, Holgado, and Alonso, then Gonzalez. Now, Gonzalez gets by Alonso at 12. Then Ramirez is down at 16. Him and Escrige are down. I don't believe that either those two actually got touched each other, but the replays were kind of inconclusive to know what was really going on. But that's where it was. Now, can I go on a tangent about how they do laps, Rich? So for the past couple of weeks, it's been pretty even. It's been like we're counting up. This is lap one, lap two, lap three, lap four, lap five. Then we get to the end and we say, hey, we got five to go. Oh, I'm okay with that. So that's how Moto 3 went. Cool. Moto 2, all of a sudden they're going the other way. It's counting down. It's like it's 22 laps, 21 laps, 20 laps. And then, well, la, they switch it back and they make it lap four. Guys, get it straight which way you're going to do this. I don't care which way it is, just make it consistent because changing in the format in the middle of the race makes taking notes really tough. I know I'm at first world problems here, people. I understand, but
Well, yeah, but I mean, even if I was not kind of trying to write notes on the race, I still would want to be kind of following that level of detail. And I suspect most people that watch races are like us on this one, Jim. I've just kind of come to the conclusion that there's a sadist in charge at Dorna when it comes to this aspect of the coverage, because I can't think of any other reason to keep changing it, literally, either within a race or between different races, just a completely different format. And why can't they just have the lap that they're on and the countdown next to it in smaller font? That's what they do in F1. I mean, in fairness, F1 get this right. I tried to sit through the Singapore F1 race. I lasted about 15 laps and I just gave up because it was just hideously boring. So I fast forwarded pretty much the entirety of the remainder thereafter. But they do at least get the lap counting aspect of that coverage correct. I mean, I don't even know why we're talking about it. It's the simplest bloody thing in the world. This is the lap number and this is how many laps there are to go. Just leave it like that. Why keep changing things? It just makes no sense to me whatsoever. It is a first world problem. Obviously, it is, but why even make it a problem in the first place?
Don't know.
It's just
I have no idea.
so bizarre to keep changing it all the time. And it is genuinely from our point of view, trying to keep notes of things, because I'm not very good at remembering if it's a 19 lap race or a 20 lap race. I mean, I can do basic deduction and stuff, but if I can't remember how many bloody laps it is in the first place, then I'm screwed. So yeah, oh, I just
I
anyway.
know. It's crazy. It's crazy. Yes. So with on lap five, it's Morera, Holgado, Guevara, Gonzalez, Alonso, Ortola. Now there are small gaps between everybody. Everybody's got like a tenth on everybody else. Alonso is then down out of 16. He had a big nasty high side. He came down,
Was big.
whacked his head too.
Oh,
Woo!
yeah.
That boy had a headache. Where's he at? Past the ibuprofen because that one hurt. It was absolutely nasty when he came down. Now, Gonzalez got by Guevara at 10. Nope, he had to go and try it again at 13. Nope, couldn't get by there. It seemed like every time Gonzalez got by, Guevara just simply came right back by him again, which actually was great racing for Moto2. Generally, we don't see any kind of a argy bargy back and forth kind of a thing. People do come through the pack and make passes, but not pass, repass, pass again, pass back. But that's what we had. I'm like, wow, this is needs a little more attention. It's a little more exciting, right?
Yeah.
Because usually these aren't.
Well, particularly not with Guevara either. I mean, although he's
Yes.
had, this is the year when he started to kind of reappear as the guy we used to see in Moto3 when he won the title. So having got to second, he was rather loath to give it up, wasn't he? So,
Sure.
and fair play to him. Yeah, doing the old Troy Bayliss thing.
Then Holgado goes down and Vietti goes down. Separate incidents, right? But it's like, whoa, we're losing people now. The top three now had a huge gap to anybody else in the field. So it was like, okay, you pretty much know that if these guys stay upright, these are the guys that are going to be standing on the podium. Now, by lap eight, Gonzalez seems to have finally gotten rid of Guevara permanently. There was no more going back and forth. So it's like, okay, let's see how this works out here. Canet had worked his way up to fourth. I mean, through all this, there's some attrition, there's carnage, there's people falling off, but Canet has put in a strong ride to be here. It's like you gotta be in the game to get there, and Canet is actually in the game, which is kind of shocking considering he hasn't qualified well for the past few races.
Yeah.
And for him to be in fourth, I thought was really good. He had moved himself up 17 places. Yeah, I get it. There were three people who crashed out, but that means you still did 14 people in a short amount of time, 9 laps. That's pretty good. So I was impressed by that. So with 10 laps in, where it is Morera, Gonzalez, Guevara, Canet, Arenas, and Ortola. So the top three are literally have like 1.2 seconds between the first two, then 1.3 between second and third. And it's like, oh, okay, it's just getting bigger. So it just gets bigger and sort of bigger as you go on there. It's like, okay, we get down to like lap 17, and Baltus is now on the move because he's made his way up to fifth. He's going to probably potentially get his way past Canet or whatever. But Morera's gone. He's like 1.2 seconds ahead of Gonzalez or whatever. Despite the fact that that Morera and Gonzalez, with like five to go, Gonzalez puts his head down. I think he wanted to try to win this, and sort of there's like a psychological warfare going on. Like Morera was just really good. But Gonzalez wanted to win because he hasn't won since the beginning of the year. I think it's been 5 or 6 races since Gonzalez has actually won. So he kind of wants to be in front of Moreira. He goes for it. He's pushing hard. In fact, he gets really two big moments in the next couple of laps. And that was like a warning sign to Gonzalez. And I think Gonzalez just said, okay, I'm not fast enough today. I'm going to take this handful of points. I have a 34-point lead. I'm going to take second place. I'm only going to lose 5 points. So no big deal. Everything's cool. Let's just ride in. The worst thing I can do is fall off. And so the race ends with Moreira in first, then Gonzalez, then Guevara, Canet, Barry Baltus, and Arenas. But that's not what really happens. There's more. A post-technical review of the equipment, which is done all the time, found that Gonzalez's motorcycle was running a version of the firmware that runs in the ECU that was not an appropriately homologated version of the software. Oops. Like, that's a bad, bad boo-boo. I don't know what they were doing. I don't know if they had slid something into that electronics packet that they shouldn't have. I always thought, and I could be wrong, if anybody knows, please let me know. I always thought that the Moto2 guys were handed a electronics package and a motor at the weekend. So there's no trickery that could be applied to it. Now, how this all happened, I don't know. It was obviously the crew somehow, some way did this because it was definitely their fault because that allowed a disqualification. So Gonzalez is then stripped of this podium. He's out. So now it's actually your finishing order is Moreira, Guevara, Canet, Baltus, Arenas, Roberts, Ortola, Vire, Dixon, Huertas in 10th. So that changes things and strikes up the championship big time. Because what was a 34-point lead becomes only a 9-point lead for Gonzalez with four races left to go. It is a battle royale now between both Gonzalez and Moreira to see who's going to be Moto2 world champion. I think this is going to be a ding dong battle here to get out. Although, I mean, I hate to see it this happen from a technicality standpoint because, man, Gonzalez has just had terrible luck here. But I really just don't understand how that actually happened. So, if you got some insight, Rich, let me know.
I'm racking my brain. I'm pretty sure this has happened to somebody else this year or within the last couple of years. And I'm thinking in Moto 2 particularly.
Really?
It'll come to me.
I always thought it was Moto 3 and it was Leopard. They had got caught with some bad electronics.
Right. Okay. Well, quite
Maybe that's what you're
possibly.
thinking about. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't remember a Moto 2.
I can remember this coming up. Now, the
Okay.
engines are basically, as you said, Jim, they're sealed units and they get kind of handed out to the teams. I think. Whilst the ECUs are control units, I think the teams have more than one. And my recollection is that when this came up previously with another team, that they used an older ECU which had the older software on it, and they just used it inadvertently and then got
Oh,
kind of
yeah.
caught out after the event. I've seen or read or heard nothing about what's actually happened in this particular instance, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's what has happened. So I don't think it's kind of malfeasance or anything like that, anybody trying to trick, because people don't try to do that. There's so many regulations and post-race scrutineering checks that go on. I suspect it's just a very simple reviewed an older piece of hardware and not realized that it's running the older version of the software, which is no longer homologated and legal for use in a race. That would be my assumption, Jim, but it's a body blow to Gonzalez, this one, because as you say, he's had some technical problems, a bit of bad luck, a couple of performances that weren't quite where they needed to be, and he's kind of on a bit of a downward trend at the minute, just at the wrong moment, as Moreira's on a bit of an ascendancy now. And with a 9-point gap and that kind of background, you kind of feel a little bit like Gonzalez is really under pressure, like big time under pressure now. You've got Moreira with his tail, high with a MotoGP contract, we believe. It's still not official, is it? Or is
We're
it
waiting
now?
for it. Yeah.
I think we're still waiting for the official. Anyway, that deal is done as far as everybody is concerned. So, yeah, I mean, the fair wind is blowing with Diogo Moreira at the moment, and I mean, 9 points is nothing with four rounds to go. So I feel a little bit for Gonzalez now because, okay, not everybody can get a graduation to MotoGP, but we all felt he was going to be the champion and would have been, probably MotoGP bound. And things have really unraveled in the last, what, four or five races. Kind of the rot started in Red Bull Ring when he had that hold radiator, if you remember, and it's been tough to watch since then. And this is, as I say, this is a real body blow for him because he's done nothing wrong. It's just one of those things. And as I say, it's reminiscent to me of something else that happened very similar elsewhere in sort of fairly recent memory. And you might be right, maybe it was one of the Moto3 teams. We'd have to look up.
As you went through that and you said the statement of they had put a bad or an older ECU into the system, I remember what you're talking about. I remember that clearly now. The first thing that popped in my head was the Moto3 guys there at Leopard. That was the first one I thought about because I think that was back way back or whatever. But anyway, it just what it came to. So anyway.
It's all playful. It can be an exciting running.
Oh yeah. So man, this Moto2 World Championship is going to be fun to watch. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think Marrera is going to win it. I hate to say that, but
Well, I don't hate to say it, but it feels that that's the sort of the direction of travel now, doesn't it? Just
yeah.
in terms of form and sort of rub of the green, as they say in snooker and billiards. You know, that's just the feeling that I've got. And again, I would need to look back at past results, but I suspect he'll do well, Moreira. This is. I'm suspecting Phillip Island, unless there's some crazy weather event, which is always possible there. Yeah, I just feel like he's got the tailwind now. It's going to be hard to stop him.
I completely agree. All right, let's talk about the MotoGP race. For
Yeah.
once, this is a great weekend for MotoGP. If you were a fan of MotoGP, you had to have loved this weekend. It was amazing. But we got to set the table, so let's look at qualifying. In the first qualifying session is Marc Marquez. Yeah, first time all year he has been in there, and he is. Bagnaia is in there after the great weekend in Japan. He's back looking like the old Bagnaia and not the new Bagnaia. We'll have to come on to that later. Then Binder, Bastianini, Digia, Zarco, and Morbidelli are there. 10 minutes in, it's Digia, Morbidelli, Mark, Binder, and those guys there. At 8 minutes and 35 left to go, Mark is on top, and he does go to there. But hold on. Digia is coming, so Digia now is the fastest person. Mark's second. Then it's Morbidelli. Bastianini goes down at 10-1, turn one. That made a yellow flag. That didn't give anybody hope anymore because it was all done. So nobody was going to get through. And basically, Bagnaia is 16th, and Mark just squeaked by to get in. And he got helped there by the yellow sectors there for Bastianini. So like, wow, this is not Mark's track, right? I mean, this is his big high side where the dilopia came back again with his eyes and stuff. So I
Yep.
mean, this is not a track that is gonna work, just works for him. It's a bogey track. It's just a place that he just isn't in tune to. So we get to the second qualifying session. Audeger goes out quick, followed by Acosta, then Digia, but then all of a sudden Bezzecchi's just like a half a second faster. He just threw down a 129.3. Just boom, mic drop. Like, wow, where'd that come from? Like, Bez was just so insanely good in that second sector. Like,
Yep.
it was so good. Alex Marquez, we went through there with him. Like, man, I cannot hang with him. I must be like half a second or three quarters of a second off of the lap pace. And then he, gets back to the pits. He looks at the, no, I'm not bad at all. It's apparently just that sector that Bezzecchi is really good in, and he's got another sector he's sort of mediocre in, and well, it's all sort of evening out, if you will. But anyway, it's like, wow, Quartararo was down in this second session. Like, did you see that coming? And like, I didn't, It's like Quartararo on the ground. That's crazy. The front end just folded, and I don't know if that was one of those things where it's that harder carcass that they have to maintain tire structure because of the heat and whatnot. But it's like, wow. But he destroyed his bike, so then he was going to have to go out on a second bike. Well, halfway through, Bez is ahead of Acosta, who's ahead of Luca Marini on the Honda, and then it's Fernandez, as in Raul, on the Aprilia, the other Aprilia, because there's only two Aprilias here this weekend. And then there's Alex Marquez and Audeger. It's like, holy crap, like this is just so shook up. You just don't know what to do because Acosta looks really good, right? And then the Hondas look good again. And you're just like, well, this is crazy good, right? It's like, wow, you eliminate the two red bikes and suddenly the world's great or something. I don't know. It's just crazy how this was. Then Bez or Audeger goes out and he has like a He's got like a bike problem. There's something wrong with the brakes, or something's wrong with Ottinger's bike. So they throw him on the number two bike. Well, that's never really like a good, you know. Oh, so then it was like, oh, what the problem was is that it was a no start. Like, for whatever reason, the number one bike wouldn't start. So he had to go out on the number two bike. Like, well, that sucks because, you know, despite what anybody will tell you about two motorcycles being built the same, they do not feel the same to a race. I don't care. You can put the exact same suspension components in both bikes, they will work differently. And you, as an average street rider, will never see it. Me, as a glorified club racer, kind of maybe understands it, but doesn't really, because I can never really tell. But these guys are that good that they can feel the difference between it, which is just the level that they're at, which I think is out to me, having done it, I think that's absolutely incredible. Like, that still to this day blows my mind that these are different, right? Anyway, we must continue in qualifying. Bez then goes into the 128s. It's like, okay, how fast can he go? You know, then Aldegar goes the second on the second bike. It's like, I thought for sure Aldegar was going to struggle, right? Maybe it's not the primary bike, but nope, he's just as good as it is there. Alex is then down at turn 13. Rins goes the third. Like, I don't know where that was coming from. If you had Rins in your bingo card to be third in qualifying, congratulations, because you are way better at this game than me. Because that was just insane that that's there. Mark was down into 12th. Like, the whole front end just seemed sketchy. Like, he couldn't find any feel. He had no rhythm. He had nothing. Then Rins blows it, and he's down at 16. All the good work to be third, and then Rins blows it. It's like, really, Rin? Really, Alan? Really? Why would he just come on? I
Yeah,
mean,
but to be honest with you, crashing out from that position, I'm still guessing he's a pretty happy guy compared to where he's been all year.
I cannot deny you that one. Anyway, Bezzecchi would take the pole position. Ottinger is going to be second. Raul Fernandez is going to be on the front row starting third. I mean, where's that been all year, buddy? Then Alex holds on to fourth. Costas fifth. Luca Marini. Alex Marquez. Fabio Quartararo. Then it's Marc Marquez, Miguel Oliveira, Fermín Gallagher, and Juan Mir. Wow, that is a flip-flop, turned-up, twisted. Like I said, this is like Qatar. It is weird stuff happens at this place. And I'm like, wow, can't wait to see what the sprint's going to be like when we get to that portion of it, right?
To be honest, Jim, the big surprise, and I can't believe I'm actually saying this, considering what a weird kind of Q2 outcome that was, but for Mir to be last was actually quite the surprise to me, because I thought he would be better than that. But yeah, I mean, you'd have got decent odds on Bezzecchi, Aldegar, Raul Fernandez on the front row, and Marquez in, what was that, 10th, 11th? Yeah, bizarre.
Absolutely crazy. All right, so then we get to the sprint. Now, Vinales has withdrawn himself from the event to go home to get his shoulder worked on or rested or just get better or whatever. But hey, he's got to do something. So he's bailed out. He's not racing. We start the sprint. Aldegar gets a hole shot, followed by Fernandez and Luca Marini. Now, Bez has a terrible start. He's back in eighth. So it finishes that, like, after the first lap, Bez has made his way to sixth. But your top three are Aldegar, Fernandez, and Acosta, then Marini. That's how they're racing right now. Acosta moves his way to second. Mark then gets a long lap penalty for bumping into Alex Rins. Justified, yep, 100%. Great call by the officiating squad. Mark was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. He's trying to force a bike somewhere where he couldn't get it to get there. And what did you get? He bumps him off. He bumps Rins off. Gets the penalty.
I was slightly surprised by the penalty, actually.
Really? I thought this one was a lot easier than the Gonzalez
Yeah.
splash one back in
I mean, this
Japan.
was on lap one going into turn 10, which is a kind of a known pinch point. I mean, there's no doubt that Marquez went in a bit hot and obviously compromised Rins' race, which, you know, for Alex Rins would have been particularly perturbing, really, given what a shocker of a year he's had, and this was the first sort of glimmer of hope, really. So I do think he sort of just about deserved the penalty, but I was kind of slightly surprised that they would give it out on, because that happened on lap one, I think, didn't it?
It's actually lap two.
Oh, was it lap two? Okay, but early on, when, you know, there's still a lot of jostling going on, people close together. So yeah, we unfortunately we're sort of talking about these penalties again, aren't we? Just a little bit in the last couple of rounds. But actually, we must just return at the end, Jim, to Gareth's email, because he did reply on the whole thing, didn't he? Anyway.
I'm in the wrong. Yeah, it's obviously it
Well,
was is you
no, it's not a question of
Gareth and you and Simon all agree. I did.
not a
I'm on
question
the
of being in
outside
the wrong. I
looking
mean, people have a different view of what happens,
I was just being funny.
but however, in this particular case, I thought it was a bit marginal to give Marquez that penalty, given that it was
Yeah.
early in the race. Anyway.
I thought he deserved it. Because I looked at it and I was like, my God, that was stupid. And maybe it's, I think it's stupid because of the caliber of rider that Mark is. It was like, look, he took his brain out for some reason and just botched it. Just plain flat botched it.
But he didn't come
And
from sort of miles back, and I always have to
true.
remind myself that through that kind of, well, we call it, or I call it a flip flop, they're probably going through there what, 130, 140, probably a bit quicker even than that. And then they're kind of, they have a moment to sort of straighten up and then hit the brakes as they go into 10. There's an awful lot going on in those few seconds, you know, and you've got to be, you know, an inch or two later on your braking point, and that's what's going to happen. So, I mean, tiny margins, aren't they, really? Anyway, he got the penalty. He wasn't complaining about it, was he, after the event? I don't think so. And it did ruin Rins's race. I mean, there's no two ways about that. But a few years ago, that would have just been classed as a what's it happens, it's a racing incident, you know?
There's a fine line because I told Gareth, I was like, there's a fine line between the nanny state and racing. And I'm old school. I very much believe what Senna said. If you no longer go for a gap, you are no longer a racing driver. I agree.
I agree.
It just seemed to me like Mark was like, dude, that was just way too optimistic. You know, that's a pinch point and you still went there anyway. And he's like, so that's how I saw it. But, we are allowed to disagree on these points. That's what
Makes
makes
it
it fun, right?
all the more colorful when we do.
Yes, it does. Oh, so Mark comes out of the long lap penalty in 13th. The Bastianini crashes out. Bez gets by Marini, but he's wide. And then Marini goes back by again. Acosta goes down at turn two. Watch the front out. Now, he was the only person who started the race, I believe, on a hard front. Everybody else had this, I think, the soft. I think that's all you get. Or he was on the medium front. He was on the harder of the tires that you could
I
have.
think that's right.
So, because I thought they took away the hard and it's just a medium and a soft and a medium. I don't, whatever. I don't know.
The harder
He had
option
the
of the
harder option on.
choices.
Let's, yeah. Yes. He had the harder option on and he went down. Now, Audiger is now ahead of Fernandez, ahead of Bez, ahead of Alex Marquez. Okay, cool. That's where Audiger suddenly has a track limits warning. Okay, fine. We got to deal with that. Bez got by Fernandez and could he catch Audiger? That was the question. Like, okay, let's see what he's got. By lap 10, Audiger is still leading Bez from Fernandez, from Alex Marquez, from Mir, and from Luca Marini. Zarco goes down and out at turn on the last 11th. And on the last lap, Bez has it down to a 3/10 of a gap to Audiger. Then Bez actually gets by Audiger. He tried to go by, then Audiger goes back by, but then Bez wins with Audiger second, followed by Fernandez, followed by Marquez. As an Alex, then Mir, Mark Marquez finishes sixth. Then it's Morbidelli, DiGiulia, and Oliveira gets a point. It's a good sprint race because you're watching Bez come through it. You had a lot of different people at the front, and Aldeguer looked incredible at this point. Like somehow the switch got turned on. Like this was Moto2-esque of Aldeguer because he had that talent, almost won that championship. Didn't, right? He put the charge on, didn't win. Ducati signs this kid to a contract a year early. He does another year of Moto2. That's a bad year for him, right? And now poof, he's on this bike and whoa. Like there were flashes of brilliance. There was podiums early on in the year, then they kind of went away, and now we show up here and like wow, he looks good. Like looks like really good. So I was like, wow, I can't wait to see what's going to happen when we hit this thing tomorrow, right? And see what happens on Sunday. So in Sunday, we get the start. And Bez, he's just heading backwards, man. Big time. And it's like, I don't know what the deal was. So Acosta's sort of out front with Marini. Then Bez and Mark Marquez touch. And they go down. Now, Bez touches Mark in the back. It knocks the back end out and Mark low sides, which would have been perfectly fine. He's sliding all the way to the track, but one of the bad things that happens to Mark is his body spins around because he's got the energy coming from being on the bike, right? And the bike goes out first and it goes out from behind. So the energy is trying to whip you around. Well, that's what it does. It whips Mark around to where he's not facing the gravel trap. So he doesn't know when it's coming. He knows it's there, but he doesn't know when it's coming. And in that instance, Mark goes into the gravel trap sort of backwards, if you will, and he bites into that gravel. and flips himself and tumbles and rolls. And then that's where Mark gets the injury from it. Now, Mark got up instantly, kind of, he did that hold your shoulder thing. And I'm like, oh God, did he break his right arm again? Because that's the first thing I thought about. But he was moving his arm pretty well, but he couldn't make it go up. And I thought, oh my God, it's a collarbone. Mark has broke his collarbone. But then he sort of kind of got it up sort of halfway. And I'm like, maybe he just really banged his collarbone. Maybe he's got a crack in his collarbone. Really thought he had done a collarbone thing. Later to find out that it's just actually his shoulder blade. Yada, yada. We talked about that in the beginning of the show. All right. So because Bez also goes down in this, which is weird, Mark's body gets caught up in the gravel, flips and rolls, and makes things difficult on his body. Bez rides straight across the gravel and doesn't really stop until he gets to like the air fence, which, you know, we've seen that as a stark contrast of how the gravel works there versus what we've seen at prior rounds where the gravel's so deep, bikes dig in and just instantly start flipping. It's weird.
Well, I think for both of them, what made it such a big crash was, we ought to talk about how the crash started in a moment, but in terms of the gravel, it's this problem of a tarmac, then gravel, but with quite a big step. And you were listening to the Race MotoGP podcast earlier on. I listened to it the other day, and I'm pretty sure that they said that this has been pointed out during the track walks on the Wednesday, Thursday, whenever they do that. And they had actually kind of skimmed it down a little bit to reduce the degree of the step in the gravel because the riders had sort of pointed out it was dangerous. Clearly, it was still problematical. And
Dangerous.
I wouldn't be necessarily hugely surprised if we don't see that that's all tarmac runoff by the time we come back next year. Because Mark obviously got launched as his body hit it and he came down hard on that shoulder. I wouldn't be surprised if he actually dislocated his as well as the fracture and he popped it back in. With Bez, I think what happened to him is he stayed on the bike, obviously, and I think he kind of was launched as he hit that step in the gravel. And by the time the bike kind of came down, he was effectively into the air fence and the camera didn't really catch it, but that was a big crash that he had as well. So all around that corner has been problematical in the past, and I don't think they can afford not to change the runoff situation there as a result of this. But I mean, anyway, going back to how this crash actually happened, you pointed it out in terms of qualifying when Alex Marquez says he's gaining half a second through that series of turns, and Bez just, I don't want to say he misjudged it, but he was just so much quicker that he just basically, well, yeah, misjudged it and just ran into the back of him. By the time he tried to save it was too late, and he just tagged the back of him, and then what happened happened. So yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things, really.
I personally think Bez panicked slightly. He got another bad start. I think he was trying to make up too much ground too fast because he knew how hard he had to work to get to Aldegar. And he, like, I'm going to take, he just, you know, misjudged it, you know, didn't think about it, just, you know, disengaged the brain for a minute and had an accident. Now, it's going to be interesting to see what the penalty is going to be because all this was going to be reviewed, you know, afterwards. Because neither of them were, you know, able to continue on in the race, and you know, everybody's injured now. I don't think Bez went to the hospital. I think they did some checks, some more X-rays, maybe an MRI. I don't think they found anything broken. I think he's just beat up, viciously beaten up from the impact that he had.
Was going to
But
say again, slightly tongue in cheek, Jim. So, have you ever seen the film It Follows? It's kind of like a reasonably modern kind of sort of psychological horror film.
No, I steer
Okay,
clear of horror
all right.
films.
I'm sure some of the listeners will have watched it. It's kind of this thing where you pass on your bad luck, basically. And it strikes me that kind of Bez has inherited the Joanne Mir kind of luck just of late, because there was a time when Mir just couldn't stop people crashing into him and kind of or being involved in crashes anyway. And Bez has kind of, yeah, sort of become the recipient of this now, although he was responsible for what happened on Sunday, it is true. But I think, as you say, Jim, he was just couldn't get the thing off the line in both races, and maybe there was an element of panic in it. I just think he was just so fast through that section, and obviously Mark didn't look comfortable all weekend, and just the two, it was just one of those sort of unfortunate things that happens sometimes. Luckily, neither of them have been like seriously injured. And it must be said, actually, it would be remiss of us not to mention that obviously Marco Bezzecchi was very apologetic about it after the event, and Also, Mark Marquez was exceedingly gracious in his kind of, sort of review of what had happened and the fact that it was a racing accident. These things kind of happen. I mean, he might not have said that if he was about to lose a championship as a result of it. Does at least have that in the bag. But Marquez, who is a rider that I'm starting to like more and more after all the years on the Repsol Honda, when I didn't really care for him very much, if I'm totally honest, as I've said before, is in his older, sort of more distinguished years now, starting to conduct himself with a lot more kind of decorum and humility than he used to do. And possibly that's a result of having come back from the injury that he had. So could have been a lot worse, but it was nasty to see anyway. And I think a big part of the problem is the way that that gravel is configured on that particular corner, and I think that has to be changed.
Agreed. We'll see what happens when they get back there next year.
Yeah.
If it happens. Mir went down at turn 10, the second lap. Audiger got himself to second. So it's Acosta, Audiger, Luca Marini, Fernandez, Rins, and Quartararo. So Fernandez then tries to go past, but he goes wide. And then Audiger goes by Acosta at turn 10. Now, not to belabor this point, but at this point in the game, since now that Audiger is in the lead, he disappears. I mean, just flat disappears. It is one of the largest winning margins I can remember in the modern era of MotoGP. Like, he just destroys everyone.
Yeah.
So, Audiger's gone. Audiger will win the race as a rookie. He becomes the second youngest one to ever win a race. Mark still holds that record for youngest ever, but Audiger does eclipse Freddie Spencer, who was second youngest because to Marquez. So that's something to think about. Anyway, so let's talk about this next section of it that happens. You get some of the most fantastic MotoGP racing you've ever seen in your life in this era. With all the electronics, all the gizmos for ride height adjustments and everything else, this was a barn burner of a race with people passing everywhere and trying to pass everywhere. And it was just completely crazy cool. It's a great race between Fernandez and Luca Marini and Acosta. And the biggest part of it is Acosta just doesn't give up. He's just fighting tooth and nail the whole way. And he's kind of the head of the, like they call it, the DRS train in Formula One. He's kind of the head of the train because he's not turning the laps that are fast enough. Everybody else is just that little smidge faster than him, but they can't get by him. Or if they do, Acosta just, little terrier on your ankle kind of a thing, just drives right back in there and goes, nope, I'm taking this back. True Troy Bayliss embodiment right there, right? I got passed. I'm gonna pass you right back next corner. I don't care. And this leads to some absolutely wicked racing that happens in between there. Now, Ben Yaya falls down at the last turn. I literally wrote, what the hell? Because that is the weirdest crash I've ever seen legitimately in a race that's there. It's the true middle of the corner, right when you're getting ready to pick the bike, when you're at your slowest opportunity or slowest that you'll be, you're getting ready to just pick the throttle up. The front really doesn't fall off. The back isn't falling off. Benyaya, who's been running around basically turning laps at the speed of a Moto 2 bike, I mean, he's like over 2 seconds off of it. Somkat Chantra is pulling away from Pecco Bagnaia when Pecco Bagnaia falls off the motorcycle. I'm wondering, Rich, if he did it intentionally. Now, I'm just saying, it's so weird, it's so odd. I don't think anybody would. I don't think he did, but it looks so odd, so comical that you almost think that he was in the middle of the corner and he just simply said, "I'm done," and just let go of the bike and fell off. What do you think, Rich? I'm confused.
I don't know what to think. I mean, obviously, we're sort of mid-race and we're going to go on a bit of a Bagnaia. Well, not a tirade, because I genuinely feel for the guy. I really, really do. Where do we start with this one without going on for too long or without me going on too long? Okay, so a theme over the weekend was this kind of what the hell are Ducati doing? Sort of confirming some stuff, denying other stuff. There was this rumor going around that Morbidelli's bike had been taken down to the Ducati pit at the Misano test, and that's what Bagnaia had ridden. Ducati vehemently denied it. I think, again, from some people that are in the know, Matt Oxley being primary amongst them, who put out quite an interesting article on Motorsport, which I think I sent you the link to that, Jim.
Yeah, I never got a chance to read it
No,
either.
okay, so it transpires that what happened at the Misano test, and I think this is close to the truth as anybody's going to get, is that it was Bagnaia's bike, but they put the 2024 ride height device on it. which operates in a slightly different way. So what Matt Oxley is saying is that whilst there are some very minor internal changes to the engine in the 25 version as compared to the 24, they haven't moved engine mounting point. The essential kind of mass of the engine hasn't changed. So it's not an engine related thing in terms of its position, you know, the center of mass, all these other sort of variables and stuff. It's basically the same. There are a few small detailed changes internally around longevity and stuff. But the big change is that the rear ride height device in particular has changed, and it's much more, you picked up on this actually, Jim, all the way back at COTA. It's much more severe in the way that it operates, and it's robbing Banyaya of front end feel. He allegedly ran the old ride height device at the Misano test, did well, took it to Motegi. I'm assuming that he took it to Motegi. I don't know that that has been confirmed, but let's assume that it was. And we saw what happened at Motegi. Let's assume he brought it to Mandalika. But here we have the heat treated tyres, which fundamentally changed the feel again. And again, he's completely all at sea. Mark didn't look comfortable all weekend, and most of the Ducatis didn't actually. I mean, it's only really Aldeguer that was kind of knocking it out of the park.
And I have a theory on that.
He's on a full fat 24 bike, so
No.
is he not?
He's got a 24 bike, right? That's true. But it isn't that he's on the 24 bike. It's the fact that Aldeguer had experience on the hard as a rock Dunlops on Moto2 bike. It was
Okay.
to me,
That's a
he when
theory,
he was
yeah.
doing it, he figured out how to run those Dunlops hard, right? So he figured out how to put the energy into him on a Moto2 bike, and he wound up winning all those races, right? Then they switched to Pirellis the next year, which is a completely different sidewall. It's softer, gooey, whatever. It's completely different. Now he's back, and he's been okay at times with the Michelins when they've kind of reused like the harder tire. Now you bring this hard carcass to survive the heat, and I think it was just magic that that just fit Aldeguer and what feel he was looking for, and it was like a homecoming. Like he just it felt right, and if it feels right, you're gonna go fast. It's like Jeremy Burgess has always said. I don't care. If he thinks he needs gold-plated handlebars to go fast, he gets gold-plated handlebars to go fast because he's going to be comfortable. So that's what I think happened to Aldeguer. That's why I think Aldeguer is so fast this weekend. Is it that's that hurrah car Dunlop Moto2 tire, and he was just dealing with it. He just knew how to ride it.
It's a great theory. I mean, I would also point out that Frankie, I'm never quite sure if it's Carcetti or Carcetti. Different people pronounce it different ways. Anyway, his
I
crew
always hear
chief.
Carcetti, but
Yeah,
okay.
I've always thought it was Carcetti. Anyway, Frankie Carcetti, let's call him, has been saying all year that Aldeguer is like really, really quick. What he hasn't been able to do is time attack and get himself on the front two rows of the grid. He's quick all race long, and he tends to get quicker as the race goes on, but he's been mired down in the pack due to poor qualifying. So he is a bit of a Mandalika specialist. He's always did well in Moto 2 at Mandalika. So I think the litmus test for him now is in these last four rounds, he's going to go to Phillip Island next. It's what we're running in towards spring there, so it probably will be chilly, stroke possibly cool, but completely different conditions to what they've just been at. Then they'll go to what, Sepang?
Yes.
I don't know if they run the heat treated tire there.
I don't know.
I'm
Good
assuming they
question.
might do, because I mean it's very hot and humid there as well. Don't know, but let's see. And then what's the race after that, Jim, before they go to the Valencia? There's one more in the middle, isn't there?
Portimão.
Portimão. Okay. So there's quite a mix of rounds in terms of conditions to come to, and with this weekend under his belt, Aldeguer might continue to fly high, or he might hit a few issues again, given the wildly different conditions. But a lot of credit has to go to Frankie Carcetti, though, for this as well. It would be remiss not to mention just how brilliant he is as a crew chief, and we've seen it with DiGiantonio. Obviously, he did a lot to help Mark in that transition to the Ducati when he did that year on the Gresini bike. He is really top draw, Frankie Carcetti, and
He is
Aldeguer's really firing on all cylinders now. And
100%.
part of the reason why Pedro Acosta was battling so hard in second was that he did not like, I'm quite sure, the fact that his fellow Murcian, I think, is the area of Spain. They both hail from basically the same place in Spain.
Okay.
They were very friendly growing up. There's been a bit of animosity. I think it's cooled off a little bit, or reduced a bit just of late. but there's a fairly healthy rivalry between those two, and Pedro is not going to be particularly pleased that Aldegar has beaten him to the punch on the first win in a GP. So I think Pedro was, I mean, he's a battler anyway. Do you know who he reminded me of, actually? Because I wrote in my notes, there's a big queue forming behind Acosta. And it reminded me, for people with very long memories, of Gilles Villeneuve at
Oh.
Jarama in 1979, where he basically held up the entire field behind him for the whole Grand Prix because he had a Ferrari that was a rocket ship in a straight line and a dog through the corners, but nobody could get by him. And he led start to finish pretty much with a mass, basically the whole of the rest of the field stuck behind him. And it kind of
Yeah.
felt a little bit like that with Acosta. He was just using the strengths of the bike and his own, obviously, innate skill at getting the thing stopped and out of the turns and just frustrating people. I mean, okay, it didn't quite turn out that way in the end, or did it? Where did he finish? Well, we'll come to that in a moment. But yeah, it was a great ride. To me, the overarching thing was this is the future of MotoGP. We're watching it in front of us with Aldegar, Acosta, and even Raul Fernandez, who's. Is starting to show flashes of the rider that everybody's been waiting to show up, really.
Throw Alonso, Rueda,
Holgado.
and Holgado in the mix, and you have top-tier people.
Yeah.
There's going to be a sea change here of MotoGP riders exiting stage left, if you will, and new guys coming on that are just going to be there. But let's try to finish the review.
Yeah.
Hitting it. Yeah, we tangented it, but what don't we do with tangents
Well, we were
anyway?
talking about Bagnaia and what the hell caused that
Yeah.
crash, and we just don't know.
Well, I was listening to the race, and they were saying that, like, okay, yes, Morbidelli's bike did go down there. The belief being that they didn't know why it was there, but Ducati steadfastly said no, he never raced that bike. Now, you telling me about Matt Oxley, I think they took the ride height device off of Morbidelli's bike and put it on his bike. Now, supposedly the motors are not that different. There's changes made to the 25 motor that was places where they made it more durable to last longer. Didn't change basically anything else. Motor mounts, geometry, weight position, all the same between the bikes. But the race comes down to the fact where they're saying that, like, basically everything about this is in Morbidelli's, or not Morbidelli, is in Bagnaia's head. That after this weekend, you go and you win and you decisively defeat everyone at Motegi, and now you show up here, and Ducati swears it's the same bike. And there was a lot of people talking that about that Ducati cheated because they ran a 24 bike when they couldn't at Motegi. And so there were some people who were willing to talk, don't know who were like, no, emphatically no, that did not happen, right?
No, they wouldn't do
So,
that.
right. So the belief is that this is all in his head. And I have said that Bagnaia was not strong mentally, especially sitting next to the guy named Marc Marquez, because Marc was simply going to take that bike and win with it. And if you look about it, you think about in the beginning of the year, Pecco was there, pretty good, pretty close. He won at COTA when Marc fell off. Tricky conditions, I understand.
Yeah.
But then after that, when Marc kind of got together with it, you start to look at where Bagnaia's races went. They started going farther back, farther back. He just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And then, boom, we magically make this happen. Well, okay, Marc's not really a fan of Motegi. He's done okay there, but he had a championship to win, which he did. And so he wasn't going to be racing that hard. But I think, maybe it is completely the way the ride height system works. Because, like I said, watching it at COTA, it just would smash itself to the ground like in a half a second. And maybe that doesn't work for Bagnaia, that robs it. But I don't understand how that robs him of front end feel, because that's happening when you're coming out of a corner and you should be riding it off the back end anyway at that point.
Well, unless it's the way in which it rebounds up when they hit the brakes going into the turns, I'm
Now, that
assuming
could be.
that I'm assuming is what his fundamental issue is. Again, I don't know the rule book inside out, of course, but I'm assuming that they could run the 24 ride height device without contravening any rules. I mean, there are certain things that are homologated, and I doubt that's part of it. It's like using a different swing arm.
I agree.
So the basic kind of outcome of what Matt Oxley wrote in that rather long article of his was that having got the field back at the Misano test and then taking it to Motegi, which is obviously a accelerate brake track where he did really well, he turns up at Mandalika with these different tyres and he's just nowhere again and his brain just completely went. And with all of this kind of conspiracy stuff floating around, spiraling around Ducati, Gigi Delina in sort of classic Don Corleone kind of summoning a few of the kind of tech guru journalists to the Ducati motorhome. I obviously Matt Oxley was there because that was the article, but I suspect Simon Patton was there, probably David Emmett from Paddock Podcast. You know, these guys that know their technical bits and bobs.
Spalding.
Peter Baum probably there. I don't know if Spalders is actually in the paddock all the time now.
Oh,
Anyway,
okay.
a few different people that, because obviously having listened to the race podcast, this was also the story. So Ducati allowed a certain amount of information to come out, having been sort of denying various things that were being whispered. I don't want to say they kind of threw Bagnaia under the bus, but the conclusion is that he just turned up at Mandalika and the bike didn't feel right again, and he just kind of, yeah,
Checked out.
not gave up, because I wouldn't accuse him of that, but kind of, yeah, checked out really, because what else can you do? And as I said to you pre-recording, you know, he said in the Friday or Saturday press conference, "I just say what Ducati tell me to say now." That's a not a good statement for a person in his position to be making, really, because it hints at a total breakdown of trust and respect, which in an Italian team of all teams is
So
not good.
wrong, man. Yeah, that's not good. I mean, I thought after they quote fixed it, right? I thought, well, okay, this is gonna turn around and we're all gonna be okay and we're all gonna be good. After this, it's a matter of deciding when the divorce papers are gonna be filed because I just don't see this. I don't see it working. I don't
I
see it.
don't see any situation where Bagnaia is not in the team next year, but I think
Correct.
for 27, I suspect a change will come. And again, I said to you before we started recording, I definitely wrote down in my notes, you can easily see now Bagnaia going to the relative comfort of the VR46 team, because obviously he's a protege of Rossi and he's always been part of the VR46
Well, he's managed by
camp,
Rossi.
managed by him. You know, because Bagnaia's situation is made worse by the fact of what Aldegard did over the course of the whole weekend, but particularly on the Sunday, and that would have got Ducati's attention. Don't be under any illusions, because I believe I'm right in thinking that when Aldegard was signed, he's on a Ducati Works contract, and he was meant to go to the Pramac team, but obviously the whole Ducati thing fell through with them, so that's how he ended up in Gresini, which, by the way, there could not have been a better place for him to go this year, particularly with Frankie Carcetti in his corner. So a couple of years in that team and then works Ducati seems like the obvious place for him to land if this kind of trajectory continues, to me, because we kind of got a bit sideswiped by his Moto2 season last year, didn't we? And thought, oh, maybe he's not the rider that we... But he's 20 years old. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, it's depressing, really, as a 53-year-old, so thinking he's 20 years old and he's just won a bloody MotoGP race. Got the whole world at his feet pretty much now, so fair play to him.
Yeah. All right. Let's try to get through the rest of the racing
Sorry,
that's up
that's gone
here.
on a bit.
No, we went off way in the deep end, but it's a good conversation to have because, you know, where else are you going to talk about it here other than that? I like I said, Outrigger's gone. So then Acosta is just like battling it out with Marini. They're going back and forth. They from turn 12 to turn 16, they just keep swapping places. It was just incredible racing to watch these guys go after each other. It was like a six to seven riders in a group that eventually got caught by Binder as he was bringing everybody up. You know, Fernandez was going up the inside of Marini, and then he got into the chase to go past Rins or try to get by Rins for third. And I know it's absolutely amazing racing that's here. You got to watch the race. You need to watch the race, guys. It's that good. Rins actually got by Acosta at turn 12, and so Rins was actually second, but Rins had a soft rear compared to everybody else running on the medium. And so that faded at the end. So everybody else started to go by. Like Alex Marquez got by Rins, Acosta got by Rins, Fernandez got by Rins. It kind of went backwards pretty bad for him at that point. For Rins, it's like, wow, this isn't really what he needed. Binder had drug everybody else back up the grid or whatever. And basically, you get to the end of the race with all the shuffling, everything that's going on. You got Aldegar winning and by a landslide, right? Acosta holds on to second, which actually Acosta started to run better laps after the tires got worn. He's like he had the grip and then he sort of lost it or needed to milk the tire because he's been hard on it for so long. Ran those laps in the middle as a consistent pace, had rubber left at the end, and then used it to his advantage to win. Of course, he's got the fastest bike there in a straight line. The KTM is a bullet from point to point. Alex Marquez on a worn medium was able to get on the podium, and then Brad Binder just missed it. So the KTM's actually looking good, right? Like, hey, they're 3-4, or sorry, 2-4 which is pretty good for them. Marini on the Honda looking good again in fifth. I mean, who thought Honda would be here and still, despite the tracks? I mean, it's going to be a little different to see what happens at PI. Much faster, flowy track, a lot of horsepower. I expect the Hondas to be down the grid a little bit, but I've seen Rins win on a Suzuki there when I never thought it was possible. So we'll see what happens.
I'm thinking Mir might have a good time in Australia.
He might. I hope he does. I hope he does. See, we had Marini in fifth, then we had Raul Fernandez in sixth. Quartararo was seventh. Morbidelli eighth. Then you had Digia in ninth. Rins settled for 10th. Then it was Oliveira, Zarco, Chantra, and Miller. It didn't matter who, if you finished, you got a point because of all the other chaos that happened or whatever. And it's just all there. So Marquez, obviously, he is your world champion. It's already been wrapped up, but his brother Alex is now on 362 to his 545. And with Mark sitting out those two races, he will not be able to surpass his 2013 points title thing where he had the most points or whatever. I think it's 13. So that's going to be pretty wild. Bagnaia is still third, but Bezzecchi is only 20 points behind Bagnaia. So I think there's every possibility that Bagnaia will be fourth in this championship. Acosta's fifth. Morbidelli is only 8 points behind Acosta. So that's something to watch. But Morbidelli, Morbidelli's actually got the better of his teammate in Digi Antonia, which is I surprises me. And then you have Audiger jumping up to eighth, and then Quartararo, and then Zarco is still 10th. So that's how everything finished. Oh, is there anything else we need to talk about, Rich? I think this has gone on long enough. I mean,
No,
we're
we need to check out. All I would say is that it was a very emotional Aldeguer on the Parc Fermé interviews. It's box office for Liberty. Aldeguer, Acosta, all of this. If they can't make hay when the sun shines on this lot, then they don't deserve to be involved, because
100%.
another box office talent really arrived properly on the scene on Sunday. An achingly pretty girlfriend as well, just like Mark Marquez. Do linger on the girlfriends quite a lot, don't they? Which is a red-blooded male, I can't help but sort of admire slightly.
I'm impressed with Mark's girlfriend. She is very stylish, very classy, very, very.
Composed.
Thank you. That's what I'm looking for. Very composed.
Yeah.
I think she is the reason Mark is the way that he is now.
Well, you never used to see females around him, did you, back in the day? And yeah, it's easy to draw
Takes
a
the right girl.
correlation between his much calmer sort of, considered. I mean, obviously he's matured,
He's
and
matured.
what he's gone through in the last few years has helped him
There's
to
more to
gain
life.
perspective. But yeah, certainly she appears to be a very positive influence on the whole scene. Yeah.
I think she's that calming part that he didn't have. Just how I see it. I mean,
Yeah.
she doesn't really seem very emotional during the races. I think it's that like calm, stable peace that Mark needed, and he has.
Yeah.
And he's really well rounded out now. I mean, this guy could win two more championships fairly, maybe fairly easily. But next year, I mean, he's got to be odds on favorite to repeat, I would think.
You would think so. No, and I was going to say his girlfriend appears to do quite a good job of keeping Mark and Alex's dad off the ceiling during the races as well, doesn't she? Because he's like always there with his crossed fingers, isn't he? The whole race long. Well, every session long. So, yeah, there's a lot to look forward to, isn't there? And the championship, despite some of the issues around the bikes, which we hope will be at least partially resolved come 2027, there's a lot to be looking forward to. And yeah, the talent just keeps on coming forward, doesn't it? The last thing, Jim, before we go, there was some really great stuff in the email that Gareth Locke sent to us. Obviously, he commented on the Vietti Gonzalez clash. He then wrote quite a bit, which I think we should return to as an off-season show, about the Moto E and where internal combustion, sustainable fuels, electric power fits in the future. I'm going to keep that email folded up in my little pile. Perhaps that's when we return to as a little bit more of a off-season chat, because there were some interesting points in there, which we won't touch on now because we're about to hit 2 hours. But we do need to go back to that, I think.
There's gonna have to be a Liberty show. There's gonna have to be a EV show.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good conversational topics to
Yes.
cover off
Yeah, so
season.
thanks, Gareth, for that. I know you replied to Gareth. I didn't because I was doing some other stuff work-wise last week, but it does bear some further discussion that. That's
All
it for
right,
me.
that's it. We're good. So, all right, everybody, enjoy your weekend of non-racing.
Apart from Estoril,
Apart from
World
Estoril, watch
Superbike.
the World Superbikes, do that.
Yeah.
And while you're doing that, ride safe.
Yeah, cheers, everyone. See you next time.